Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Atom Ventures, and I'm here today with Nicholas Ely from Point Two Surveyors. Say hello, Nick.
Hello, Bhairav.
So today we're going to talk about Nick's time in the Royal Navy and a little bit about his current work, which is around right-to-light surveying. And what we want to try and explore is how Nick's journey into the Royal Navy and how it was to work and live on a submarine. So Nick, can you just tell us a little bit about your journey into the Royal Navy? What made you choose the Royal Navy as opposed to any other service?
Yeah, so the first contact I had with the armed forces is when I was at school in the Combined Cadet Force. And there wasn't actually a Navy section there. It was only the RAF and Army section. And so I joined the RAF section because I wanted to fly, basically, to work with machinery, as it were. And I did that for up until the age of 18, from 13 to 18. And that was great fun. Learned a huge amount of skill sets, which I still use today. But then I went to university and I was speaking to new people and getting new experiences and decided to join the AWOS, the University of Royal Naval Unit. And so I did that for a period of time and really enjoyed it. And actually what I found is I like working with machinery. I like big toys, effectively. And so I thought a career in the Navy would be good fun, potentially with going into the submarine service, but I didn't really want to make that decision too quickly.
So you started your basic training at Britannia Royal Navy College. So can you in Dartmouth, can you tell us a little bit about your initial training there and how did you eventually end up in the submarine part of the Navy?
Yeah, so it was always in the back of my mind to join the submarine service, but I thought I'd just park that for a period of time whilst I go through basic training. So basic training is for a warfare officer, lasts for a year, in your first term, as it were, and it works very similar to a sort of school year. The first term is about basic standards, militarization, effectively, right time, right place, right rig, and giving you skill sets such as leadership. And then you have the second phase, which is a maritime phase, where they teach you more about sailing a vessel, effectively, and navigation. And then the third term is primarily focused on warfare. And then you pass out of Dartmouth, and it pushes you out of the fleet.
You mentioned warfare officer. What is a warfare officer?
Yeah, so a warfare officer is one of the several branches within in the Navy. And a warfare officer is specifically involved with navigation and warfare, i.e. fighting that ship or submarine or whatever it might be. But there are other branches, and they include logistics branch, engineering branch. There's even a padre branch, so someone who's a religious man might join up. There's a medical branch, so you can join as a doctor. And so what happens is you get streamed early on in your interviewing before you join the Navy and decide then which branch you want to go into.
What makes you a good warfare officer?
The skill sets of a good warfare officer, to be fair, are actually the same skill sets as being any good officer. Being capable and effective at your job. But being an officer, it's clearly a leadership role. And so effectively, what you're really looking for in someone is to be able to be a leader of men and women. And regardless of the job you do, that's probably the primary thing that people are interested in. So I wouldn't be too fussed about someone going into it and saying, I don't necessarily feel like I have some sort of skill sets, because any skill set you need, the Navy will teach you, because there's no other industry outside of the Navy which will teach you how to be a warfare officer. So just to have those sort of strength of character and determination are the key assets you probably really require.
How come you decided to deploy yourself on a submarine? Or how did you, was that a choice that you made, or was that?
Yeah, it was a choice that I made. But I wanted to get involved in submarines because you start getting involved in the crunchy end of warfare more quickly than, say, a surface ship like a frigate or a destroyer. And I decided that that's really the path that I wanted to go down. However, it's a strange environment. So I didn't really want to make the decision too early. So what I did is, after I finished Dartmouth, I went into surface fleet, did my training on the surface fleet, which is the normal career path. Went out on HMS Kent to Gulf War II and did that for roughly 6 months. Came back to some more warfare training. and then went out on another ship called Exeter, where we were 6 months in the Far East. And that was the most amazing time I'd ever had, going doing all these port visits and seeing all these amazing countries. And I'd felt at that time I'd probably seen all I was really going to see. And in actual fact, what I really wanted to do is, now I'd had a lot of the fun part, I wanted to get into the crunchy warfare side of things. So I decided that actually the best way to do that was to go into submarine service.
We're living in COVID-19 times, having to stay at home for a number of weeks. Now, you've been on a submarine for months and months. Typically, how long is a deployment on a submarine?
Well, I mean, they can range to from, say, a couple of weeks to maybe 6 to 9 months. You're not necessarily underwater for 6 or 9 months. So you're limited by food. But obviously, all the submarines are nuclear powered. So they can stay underwater almost indefinitely, say 25 years. As the limiting factor is always is people and food. So you might go a week, 3 weeks, 2 months underwater, depending on what you're doing. And then you could pop up somewhere in the Far East, the Middle East, or South America, restore, and then go about your patrol again. But you might well be away for 6 or 9 months. My longest time away was probably about 7 months.
So that's a long time. So how do you prepare yourself for that? How do you prepare yourself knowing that you're going to be there and not, I guess, maybe, I don't know how much daylight you see in that time, but you know you're going to be stuck there with hundreds of other people. How mentally do you kind of prepare yourself for that journey?
Yeah, a lot of it's training. There are no passengers on board submarines. Everyone is really busy. Everyone has a job to do. Space is very tight, so you don't really have spare people. You might have additional people if they're training. So you prepare for it by being focused and understanding what you need to achieve, and also understanding that other people are relying upon you to do your job effectively. So training is a big part of it. Focus is a huge part of it. And knowing that you're relying on others and others are relying on you actually focuses the mind to be able to do push you to do the job properly. Yes, it's very difficult, but once you're resolved to the fact that you are going away for this period of time, the most difficult aspect isn't necessarily going away. It's when there's a mishap. So you know you're going away for 6 months, 9 months, 3 months, whatever it might be, but something might happen which pulls you alongside again, and it's that disruption which is more difficult to deal with than the focus of going away for a period of time. So once you resolve that's what you're going to do, then I think it's actually quite easy to get on with the job.
Because I think people listening now, obviously those guys in lockdown, will be wondering, you know, okay, focus is a great example. You know, how do you maintain focus throughout this long period, especially when you're working at home and you've got lots of different distractions? And okay, many people aren't working, but obviously some people aren't, and those who are finding it hard to kind of maintain focus on the one thing that they need to do, because obviously there's kids and there's TV, Netflix, the next series, or whatever it is that's out there to distract them. So I guess in many ways you don't have a lot of those distractions on the submarine, but you still, you know, your mind would wander. So what was in the training that allowed you to maintain that focus?
I wouldn't necessarily say it was in the training as such, but what I would say is the important thing that we always maintained was routine. In a submarine, you're doing a two-watch system, 6 hours on, 6 hours off, 6 hours on, 6 hours off in a 24-hour period, and then you might maintain that for several months at a time. And so I would maybe start my shift at 0700 and then go on for 6 hours, and then in my off-watch period, which would be the afternoon of that day, I would probably be doing planning, looking at intelligence or chart work. And then I'll go on watch again, and then I would come off watch. We would always watch a film together as the warfare officers in that watch period to get a bit of downtime. But what you find is that everything is in a set routine, and it's very important to stick to that set routine. So what helps is that we have every Friday is fish and chips. Every Saturday night is always a steak night. Every Sunday lunchtime is always a Sunday roast. So if you can get yourself into a routine, it actually really helps to plan your day and be effective and keep focused.
Just out of interest, were you with the same people on each deployment, or would that crew rotate? Would you would you know everyone that you'll be with?
You would know everyone to a certain extent. The submarine service is quite small, so you will always know most people. There are always people coming and going. So typically, you do 2 months. You do two years on board a unit, and then you'll go off, do some training, and then come back maybe to a different unit or to the same unit in a different job. So you do know most of the people, but there is a constant turnover. So I'd say, you know, you'd probably look at maybe 20% changing of people every year as promotion happens. So you do know them, but they're always changing as well, if that makes sense.
Sure. So I guess because you've got such a diverse set of people on the submarine, not everyone's going to be able to handle things in the same way. And I guess that's, again, what people are seeing at home when they're living with their other halves and their whole families and under the same roof. So how did the Royal Navy deal with that when you had different people kind of, I guess not everyone would have had the same mindset or the same ability to kind of cope with the situation they're in. How was that handled?
So most people want to be there. I think that's the difference is that no one is forced to be in the navies. And while some people do get volunteered to be in the submarine service very occasionally, at the end of the day, it's not national service. You can leave if you wish to. So most people are motivated to be there. People do have different pressures. A lot of these pressures come from home life generally. And in some respects, it's quite easy to shut yourself away and just focus on the job. But there is a little bit of contact with home through emailing systems. And that does make things quite complicated. So what we do have is we have a divisional system. So I, as an officer, would be looking after maybe 10 or 15 guys. And there is a chain of command there. And it's not just a command of, you know, you will do this, you will do that. That's not really what it's there for. It's like a little family more than anything. So if someone's got a problem, they can speak to their superior, their one up. And if that person can't solve it, then it go up the line. So the important thing actually is compassion for each other and actually often just talking through problems with people is almost a form of therapy in itself. And so if anyone's got sort of problems, we're open and honest about them and generally resolve those sorts of problems. And if it's really bad and someone needs to go back to home for a family emergency, we are sometimes able to do that. But I think it's important that brotherhood is really important within the service. And I think that's what gets us all through.
So is that the same way that you manage conflict then as well within your team, let's say, or even within other people?
Most definitely. Yes. So conflict management is important. We're all in the same boat. We've all got problems of our own to deal with in our personal lives. And it's a high pressure environment. So it's very difficult. But what you've got to let people get things off their chest. You've got to be very open and honest with people. So if something's irritating you, you need to tell people something's irritating you. But you've also got to understand that the reverse is true. So you have to let people be honest with you as well about problems that they're having with you, so you can talk through and resolve them. So the big thing is communications with each other and compassion. But also, if someone really is being difficult, going off the rails, it's about reining them in and telling them, okay, you've got this, you've got to get this off your chest, understandable. However, you're taking this too far now. So it's about being very robust and honest with people.
So you once said to me that being on a submarine is 98% boredom, 1% fear, 1% action. So how do you deal with the 98% boredom? And then how do you go from boredom to action, I guess, via fear?
Yeah, so it's probably a little bit of a flippant comment. Certainly in operations, you're not always firing at people or doing these sorts of things. But the boredom is overcome by doing the job. So, yes, it can be quite routine going from A to B or whatever it might be. But as long as you've got something to do, the boredom is overcome by doing that job and preparing and thinking ahead. And this is the other thing, is actually it's not getting too stuck in the moment, but it's always looking ahead. What's going to happen next? What problems am I going to need to resolve? And actually, when I get back alongside and see my family, who am I going to meet? What am I going to do? So it's always looking ahead to keep yourself motivated. It's not wallowing in self-pity in your present situation.
So, I mean, how do you keep yourself sharp? I mean, that's one thing. And I guess a lot of people at home now are going to be wondering, you know, they will have obviously have some people, like I said before, some have work to do, some don't. But then a lot of people will be thinking, well, when I go back into work, will I be a little bit rusty? Will I, you know, what will I have forgotten? How do you kind of keep that sharpness?
You're always training. So you're always doing things to keep your skills as best as they possibly can be. So if you're going from a UK port to your area of operation, within that you'll be training. So you'll be looking at tactics on evading a torpedo attack. You'll be looking at firing weapons and training people to actually do that part of the job. You'll be doing fire exercises, flood exercises, all these sorts of things, which make sure that when you're in that battle situation, that everything is second nature that you react to, but it also focuses you on what you need to be doing. So it's training is a very important thing. It's what we do most of, because every action needs to be sort of a reflex that you don't even think about, that you just are able to undertake. So that's what keeps people focused and motivated. And knowing what is important to them as well, in terms of how people are relying on them.
That's interesting, actually, because obviously those who are furloughed can't work, but they can train. So hopefully their employers are promoting training and helping them stay sharp. So how old were you when you actually joined and when you left?
I joined in 2002, so I was 21, and I left the regular Navy. I was in 2008, so I was 27. So I did 6 years in the regulars and then joined the reserves, and I've been in the reserves ever since.
So that's a good chunk of time. So, you know, how do you feel you changed? What did you take away from the Navy during that period? I guess you joined very young, so that's the formative years in a way, right? How did it shape you? How did you mold you? What did you take out of it?
It's one of those funny things is you don't really think about what skill sets you necessarily have until you're asked to think about them, and that's one thing I had to think about when I was leaving the Navy. A lot of it's people skills, people management, and how to motivate people and bring them in. Leadership is one of those things that people talk about all the time, but it's notoriously difficult to do properly. Very few people are natural leaders. I don't necessarily think that people are natural leaders. I think leadership is developed over a period of time. Yes, some people have confidence, understandably. But the point is that leadership can be developed, and anyone can do it if you focus on it and do it properly. So I think I take away leadership. I take away people skills and resilience, my ability to change. I mean, if you look at the jobs in the Navy, you're constantly doing new jobs and having to retrain. So you're never turgid. And I think if I felt that I was getting turgid, I would always want to move on. So it's important to move up and improve yourself as an individual. You never stop improving. You shouldn't stop improving until the day you die. Otherwise, you're already dead. You're just a dead man walking. So you should always be focusing on what you need to do to improve yourself, because you can always improve yourself. So I've taken that away to be very self-critical. And to make sure that I can be the best that I possibly can be, because I'm far from perfect.
So knowing you, I'm sure you'd recommend entering the Royal Navy for anyone, but do you think that there are people out there that it does work for better than others, or, you know, people who shouldn't really consider it?
I think that the only people that shouldn't consider it are the people that don't want to do it.
Fair enough. That makes sense. Yeah.
So if you want to do it, then you should do it. And if you want something badly enough, you are not the wrong person in that job. So in essence, I would always you know, you have some very talented people and some less talented people in life. That's always going to happen. But I'd rather have someone who's less talented and wanted to be there and do the job, because in the end, you find they're far more effective. So there are no wrong people. There are just people who do want to do it and don't want to do it.
And I think that translates into the business world as well. I mean, of course, there are certain jobs that you need a certain skill level to do. But even with that, if you've got the if you really show that this is something you want to do, then that's obviously much more important than trying to fit yourself into something that is not necessarily the right for you. So how was the transition from the Royal Navy to corporate life, moving into business? Because as you said, you know, when you there's nothing that can really train you for the Royal Navy. There's no other job that's equivalent. So when you're coming out, what did you see yourself? And obviously, you talked about leadership skills and resilience. But you know, when you're coming out in the corporate world, you don't necessarily have some of the certifications that other people have. So how did you find that transition?
I left in 2008, and I had to give a year's notice. So when I put my notice in 2007, everything in the economy was looking rosy. But 2008 came round, and the job that I had lined up was disappeared effectively. So it was actually quite difficult. And it was difficult because even people who had skill sets in the civilian world and had been doing it for a long time were losing their job. And so you're competing against people who have been in that world for a long time. So it's difficult. And when you look at when you go to a lot of employers, They a lot of them would turn around and ask me what professional experience I've got, or whatever it might be, and I couldn't tell them what experience I had in the professional world apart from the Navy, and so that was quite difficult to translate to people. They couldn't necessarily see through what their idea of what the Navy was. So it was difficult, but that resilience that the Navy paid off, instilled into me, paid off. And that adaptability in the will to change. So when the landscape around you changes, you, as the Navy, so you improvise, you adapt, and then you overcome. So it's not about, again, wallowing in the self-pity that I spoke about earlier. It's about going, right, this is the situation. Where do I want to be, and how am I going to resolve it? And that was difficult. But in the end, with perseverance and with determination and a bit of brute force and ignorance, you kind of power through that. So it was difficult, very difficult, the transition at that particular time, but doable.
How did your transition compare to others that left around the same time that you did?
I think we all had a hard time, to be honest with you. I think everyone who left at that period of time, I mean, a lot of people who had their notices in decided not to leave. My issue was that I made a decision to leave based on the facts that were presented to me, and the facts that made me want to leave the Navy hadn't changed. So I had to stick. I felt I had to stick with my decision because the world around me or in front of me had altered. All it would mean is that I would have to adapt to that alteration. But I think everyone had a hard time of it at that particular time. But to be fair, I think a lot of people in the civilian world had a hard time of it and had to go through similar sorts of transitions. And I think a lot of people decided to set up and become self-employed at that period, become master of their own destiny.
So you've been out now for quite some time, and you've worked in the corporate civilian world for a fair number of years now. So, you know, if you're looking at the corporate world and you're looking at the world within the Royal Navy, you know, what do you think the Royal Navy can teach the corporate world at this point in time? Not necessarily just during this COVID-19 period, but you know, what have you seen in the corporate world where you thought, well, hang on, there's these techniques within that we learned during training that could easily be replicated across and help people through their own journeys in the business world?
Well, the important thing to know is you're never the finished product. So you must keep moving on, keep focused. So self-improvement is something that's really pushed harder in the armed forces. And actually, I think that probably should be pushed forward more in the civilian world. Adaptability. We all need to recognize that we need to adapt. And I think that's crucially important because nothing ever stays the same. So you have to be a master of change and change the situation that's around you. I think that's crucially important. But the other thing that's, I suppose, in many respects, fairly obvious, but it's the leadership skills. And what may not be obvious, however, is that everyone seems to think that the armed forces is very authoritarian, but in actual fact, it's not as authoritarian as people like to think it is. And leadership, good leadership, is not necessarily authoritarian. Leadership is about empowerment and actually using your people underneath you to make decisions. So you have, if you have 10 people underneath you, 20 people, it doesn't matter how many, you're using all those brains underneath you to make decisions, as opposed to you at the top being a single brain making the decision. It doesn't matter how clever you think you are and how capable you think you are. You're only one brain, one person. Whereas in actual fact, you need to motivate people to start making decisions. Because then once you have all these people underneath you making decisions, you have a groundswell of good decision-making made at the coalface as well. And that's the important thing. So someone in a submarine, for example, making a decision on the engine room is much better placed to make that decision than the captain. The captain might be incredibly talented, but he doesn't know what's going on there. And this is the important thing. This is an actual fact. You're pushing decision-making down and you're motivating people to actually make decisions and empowering them to have the confidence. Clearly, you have to train them. And clearly mistakes are going to happen along the way and people are going to make mistakes. But I think that's very important.
So that's interesting. So I think what you find today in a lot of, well, I think not just today, but over time, you know, you've seen, or I've definitely seen in companies I've worked with, you've got a lot of micromanagers, you've got a lot of people second guessing the people, the experts within the field. And actually you see that happening in politics today anyway. But, you know, from what I gather from what you're saying here is that, you know, there's no time to micromanage on a submarine. Everyone who's there making a decision is, you know, you've empowered them with the skills that they need to make those decisions. And it's really about trust then to say, okay, these guys, if you've given them the right training, then to trust them to make that decision. And then really you're just coordinating across all of that to make sure that it's all consistent.
Trust comes from training because, you know, at the end of the day, yes, you want people to make decisions, but you can't just take someone and say, right, go and do this. He doesn't have, he or she won't have a clue what to do. So you need to train people. That's clearly important. But the way leadership works isn't necessarily by big choppy arms and shouting and all the rest of it. It's about leader saying what their intentions are. So it's not necessarily saying we're going to go from A through to D, and this is how we're going to do each individual maneuver. It's about saying we're A, and our intention is to get to D, and then using your people to make the decisions who are at the coalface about how best to tackle that journey from A to D. So really, it's not about orders; it's about intention. And once people are on the same wavelength, that actually our intention is to do X, Y, and Z, then all of a sudden you are getting people to think about what decisions they need to make in their specific role, as opposed to making the decisions for them. And all of a sudden you're growing people, you're giving them confidence, and you have all of a sudden many brains working on this one issue, as opposed to just yours as a leader.
So there's much more collaboration than I think most people would have expected in this.
A huge amount of collaboration. A huge amount. I mean, for example, so on a submarine, or in any job that I've done, it's about recognizing where you're not an expert, or maybe you are the expert, but that's almost irrelevant because you've got people working with you for a reason. They are there to make decisions based on the intent that you set out. Now, we also have something called command by veto in the Navy as well. And that all forms within that intent. So it's not necessarily sitting back and when it all goes wrong, going, oh, woe is me. Oh, it's all my fault. I should never have given these people this power in the first place. At the end of the day, as a leader, you give the intent and then people come back with you with their decisions. And then if there is a decision which you don't think is safe or good, then you veto that decision and you tell them why. The important thing is to always explain why. So the intention is to do this because. And then once people understand that why, that's the important thing in terms of leadership. And you may veto a decision, but you need to explain why you vetoed that decision. what you shouldn't be doing is veto a decision because you've decided that that's not the way you would do it, because there are always many ways to skin a cat. But it's normally a fundamental reason. So certainly a submarine will be safety, a safety reason.
Right. So I think one thing you've definitely, just talk a little bit about your current career now. So you've shown a little bit of adaptability with the number of different jobs you've had since you've left the Royal Navy. I guess, can you talk us a little bit through that journey to where you are now at Point Two Surveyors and what you actually do there, and what does it mean to be a right to light surveyor?
Yeah, so I've jumped around a bit, not intentionally, but just because that's the terrain that was presented to me. So I worked for a period of time in a webcasting company. That wasn't an ideal job, but it gave me some essential skill sets, which I use to this day. I then started working for an insurance company to try to get into shipping insurance, because really that's where I wanted to be. That's where I thought I wanted to be anyway. I didn't really enjoy insurance that much, but again, it gave me some skill sets. And then an opportunity came up to work in defense. And that was more of where I wanted to be, actually. I really enjoyed that job. I worked for BAE Systems and an amazing company called Fraser Nash, great engineering companies, both of them, really. And that gave me the ability to spread my wings a little bit more. That's where I wanted to be. But an opportunity came up. A friend of mine is also ex-Navy. He'd started a company. He left the Navy a few years before me, so didn't necessarily jump out in such a choppy period that I did, and was able to establish himself with a career. And he asked me when he was setting up his company whether I'd like to join, because he wasn't looking for an end product. He wasn't looking for someone with the skill sets to be He was looking for someone with the skill sets to be a surveyor, but he wasn't necessarily looking for someone who was a surveyor. Because he was going to, in many respects, like the Navy, he was going to teach me how to be a surveyor. He just wanted to make sure that he had someone who was motivated and had a reasonable amount of intelligence about him to be able to execute his master plan, shall we say. And so he phoned me up one day, and I thought to myself, well, actually, this sounds like a lot of fun. I think I want to do this because it sounds interesting. And that's how I became a surveyor, and I've been doing that since 2017.
So what is a right to light surveyor?
There's two facets to right to light surveying. There's daylight, sunlight, and that is when a developer needs to get planning permission. One of the key areas that they need to satisfy is whether they are whether their development doesn't place too much damage, shall we say, on the light of residential properties in the local area. And so we will run a survey on the surrounding properties, and then work out the difference between the existing scenario and the proposed scenario, which might be the difference between a two-story building and putting up a six-story building. And we will assess their daylight to make sure that the reductions are not significant enough to be a problem for the local residents. Now, what you must bear in mind is that local authorities will be looking at a number of different sort of factors in approving something. And it might be that this new development provides a lot of public realm and provides a lot of social housing. One of the downsides might be that they are reducing someone's daylight quite significantly, but they have to look at the round. They have to almost be utilitarian and understand what the overall benefits are for the scheme. So linked to a light factor, but something separate from the planning system, is what's called rights to light. And that's a common law easement. So an easement is a right of way. And if I've had an aperture in the side of a building for over 20 years, that has what's called a prescriptive right. So whilst the local authority may have granted planning permission for the development to occur, what that doesn't cover is a right to light. And so if someone is injured, i.e. they are left with less than 50% of a room, which is well lit, then they have a right to come forward to either maybe injunct the property, but primarily, I would say, to get some compensation for their light loss.
So just out of interest for some of the listeners out there, if they do have that situation now, would they come to you initially to do that kind of assessment as to where they start their legal proceedings?
Yeah, so someone who's impacted might come to me, or someone who's developing might come to me. So we work on both sides of the fence.
All right. Okay, so final question for you. If you could go back in time 20 years and give advice to your younger self, what would that advice be?
So as you might have gathered, I've done a number of different things, a number of different jobs. Some of them have been better than others, and some situations have been good, and some situations less so. And the important thing is when a situation looks bad, it actually is not necessarily a bad thing to be in a stressful and bad situation, because you learn a lot from it. So however bad the situation might be, there's something that you can take away from that bad situation and learn from it and grow as a person. Someone who is unstressed throughout their lifetime is not necessarily the most effective person. Someone who has been through some stress, and I say I stress some, not constantly all the time, is actually someone who is adaptable and resilient. And that's really important. And there are so many skills that you can learn, even doing things that you don't wish to do at a specific time. There's always something you can take away from it. And pain, if you want it to be, is always short term.
So I guess what you're saying to your younger self is battle through it, you know, that there's going to be better times ahead. Yeah. And you're going to learn from it.
Don't wallow in your self-pity. Look at what you're doing. Keep focused and keep moving forward. But also recognize that even the things that you're not enjoying at the moment, you're learning from. And so it's actually very important to learn from bad situations. You learn more from your mistakes than your successes.
Yeah, that's true. They're very true. All right, thanks for that, Nick. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Thank you. That's been enjoyable.
Cheers.